Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, we're going to find out how vitamin C improves survival in deficient mice, and how that could correlate to humans. And there's a nutrient that can impact gene behavior. And we're also going to look at how a certain nutrient can help men with erectile dysfunction. So you don't need the toxic drugs, a simple nutrient. And how you can extend your life with isoflavin. And how higher lycopene levels are linked to lower death rates. And what blueberries do to your brain, and why baldness is linked to prostate cancer death, and so much more. The guest we're going to have in the second part of our program today is Chris Hedges. He is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics and social and political activists and investigative journalists. We're going to continue with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, conversations about some of the most forbidden topics in America today, the ones the mainstream media won't touch, and why. Also today, a brief commentary from the Consortium News, Lawrence Davidson, America and the Plague of Moral Idiocy. Also today, I'm going to do a lot on the environment, including about the pace of climate change and how it's too hot for many crop seeds to grow. We're also going to hear today from one of the most insightful minds of the last century. Most of the people know who it is, but it's what he says that should give us a pause to think about our society today and how we treat each other. Also, did you make any money off Greece's failure, their austerity programs? No. Someone did. Lots of money. Who could that have been? Will tell you how they did it. Did they have someone inside who knew what was going on in Greece? Yeah, they did. Also, we were told by James Comey, the head of the director of the FBI, that there was not probable cause with intent, so that's why they didn't indict Hillary Clinton. Really? There are a whole lot of FBI agents out there talking who were part of the investigation who said otherwise. But we're not going to hear from them. We're going to hear from the former FBI assistant director, the second in command behind Comey, who has a different perspective. Oh, and the vice presidential candidate under Hillary Clinton, really pro-immigration, pro-open borders, pro-vote for Democrats if you're an immigrant. Has this always been his position? We found an audio clip I think you'll find of interest. So you see, we have a lot to share, always with the idea of empowering. Let's begin. First up, we know that when we're taking lycopene, and you're going to get more lycopene if you're having tomato juice each day, or some watermelon, or red plum, or red sweet pepper, which is good. This is according to the Journal of Nutritional Research. That higher lycopene will lower your risk of death over a follow-up of those who had metabolic syndrome. You're going to be less likely to die if you have high levels of lycopene in your body. That's a carotenoid, and it gives the tomato and watermelon their vivid red color. Raspberries also are good. A team at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha evaluated 2,499 participants who enrolled in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey and found that those over a five-year period who were using a lot of carotenoids, had them in their diet, quote, had a 39% lower risk than those in the lowest category of dying. So eat the red and live a longer life. Now, isoflavin, that's what you get when you get the soybeans, organic non-GMO soybeans. You can get it in the protein powder. You can get it if you eat the soy, dry roasted soy nuts Or if you eat edamame, which is also a great snack, you can get it as well. This is according to the FASEB Scientific Journal. Quote, isoflavone extends life of fruit fly. And by the way, the fruit fly is used as a biological marker in aging as applied to humans. And this was a study done this year, and it showed that it lives longer with this particular nutrient. So if we eat more soy, like the Japanese and the Chinese have for millennia, then there's no reason we couldn't be adding quality time onto our life. Now also, since they found that the flies given this particular nutrient increase in the expression of the longevity gene, which I mentioned yesterday, the ASERT1 gene, and makes them more active, greater fitness, longer lifespan. So here's the key. Have good soy as a part of your diet. That means having things such as miso, so you're getting the good probiotics. You could also, by the way, have tempeh, which is a great replacement for those who want to give up bacon. There's a natural seasoning that tastes just like bacon. It's made from a hickory, and you baste your tempeh strips in the hickory, and then you bake it at low temperature. You can even dry it in a 115 degrees, which means it's still raw, so it tastes like bacon, looks like bacon, smells like bacon, but it's not. It's a very high protein, high quality, isoflavin rich, probiotic rich food. Tempeh. Lots of ways you can use it. A lot of men, if you watch the ads, have erectile dysfunction. They tell you to take a pill. And then they want to say that, well, now if you're out and you're dancing or you're walking and you want to have sex, well, you don't want to have the inconvenience of having to reach for the pill, so take it in the morning, I guess, and it works all day. And then it ends with two people looking out at a lake in two separate bathtubs. Now, that's kind of interesting because think of it. First of all, where would the water go when you let it out of the bathtub if you're in front of a lake? How did the water get in the bathtub, and how did the bathtubs get by the lake, and exactly how you're supposed to have sex in one of the, or both of those bathtubs? There's so many unknowns to that ad. Well, you don't need all that, and possibly a heart attack in the process. Instead, if you're having erectile dysfunction, according to the Journal of Sexual Medicine, you can have taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E. This was a good study, and it found improvement in erectile dysfunction, and especially people who have diabetes. And taurine, by the way, is an amino acid. And diabetic humans are 300% likelier to experience erectile dysfunction than non-diabetics. So for all the diabetics, and how many pre-diabetics and diabetics do we have in America? About 100 million, almost one-third of the entire adult population. So we have a lot of erectile dysfunction, so taurine can make all the difference in the world. And what happens is it significantly reduced the fibrosis as well as the upregulation of endothelial nitric oxide, and that's an expression improvement in the erection. So no reason not to be able to have that. Now, for those of you who've been using vitamin C, good for you, because this study showed that supplementing with vitamin C corrects some of the deficits observed in this laboratory experiment to an enzyme that rendered them, like humans, unable to manufacture the vitamin. So it means that you're able to have greater survival with higher levels of vitamin C. So I would suggest taking vitamin C 6 times a day. When you get up in the morning, after you finish your workout, mid-morning, after lunch, always good after a meal or with a protein shake, mid-afternoon, early evening, and before you go to bed. And the most important time to take vitamin C is before you go to bed. If you take vitamin C, vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, magnesium, hawthorn, before you go to bed, and cayenne, you're far less likely to have a stroke or a heart attack, and that's when most of them occur. So that could help save a life. Also, we found that blueberries are good for us on a lot of levels. More and more research is showing that blueberries, a serving, which is a cup a day, or blueberry concentrate, can help with impairment in cognition. Now, improved cognition function is associated with blueberry consumption. And think of all the Americans who are in their 40s and 50s and start to lose parts of cognition. By 50s and 60s, you see an awful lot of. By 70s, it's epidemic, where a person walks into a room and doesn't remember why they came in. Person forgets where they left their keys. Person sees something and doesn't remember what they say. Had a conversation, can't remember the conversation, even if the conversation was an hour before. That's when they start to lose that cognition. And that's when they have a difficulty with life. For those of you who are concerned about prostate cancer, there's an article in the American Journal of Epidemiology found that male pattern baldness is linked not only to a higher risk of developing prostate cancer, but also with a higher risk of prostate cancer death. And they studied 4,300 men for this study. They found that researchers found the risk of forward death from prostate cancer was 56% higher in men with any baldness than in those with no baldness. And men with moderate baldness had an 83% higher risk of death. So how do we deal with this? Well, there's two ways. First and foremost, we need to get the inflammatory agents out of our diet because it's the pro-inflammatory foods and beverages, coffee, soft drinks, alcohol, hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, pizzas, toast, muffins, bagels, donuts, anything that has been cooked where the outside surface of a carbohydrate is browned, that creates acrylamides, and that contributes to our prostate inflammation. Now, the meats in the diets, any form of meat that is cooked, and you have to cook meats, otherwise you end up with the potential of bacterial infection or parasites or worms, it creates heterocyclic amines, and that is very high up on a causative list of inflammation to the prostate gland. Sugars are harmful to the prostate gland. So when you clean up the diet, you get a clean, healthy, living foods diet, you then turn off inflammation to the prostate. Now, if you've had any damage because of earlier lifestyle bad habits, go in and help rejuvenate the prostate. Saw palmetto, Africanum pygium. Very important would be vitamin C, buffered form, and also quercetin. Also, I would look at cayenne, very important, and the isoflavones from soy also help. So these are the things that can help your prostate if it's enlarged, if it's inflamed, or if it's cancerous. And also, there's a new study that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that's urging younger people to get their blood tested. Why? Because they're finding out a lot of young people are unhealthy and don't know it. In fact, they're finding high levels of the bad LDL cholesterol, which can give you a 560% more likely calcium buildup in arteries by the age of 45. So teenagers have such terrible diets that they're predisposing themselves because of the diet to destruction of their interior artery lining, the epithelium, which leads then to heart attacks and strokes later in life. And so get tested. Magnesium is linked to a reduced diabetic risk. This was in the journal Biomedical and Environmental Science. And they found from 15 separate articles that if you have enough magnesium, it helps protect you from type 2 diabetes. So I would suggest between 800 to 1,000 milligrams, even 1,200 milligrams of magnesium per day. And fish oil and vitamin B12 reduce plasma homocysteine. This was in the Pacific Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it showed that when you take 2 grams, that's 2,000 milligrams of fish oil a day, and 1 milligram, which is 1,000 micrograms, vitamin B12 per day, you substantially reduce your C-reactive protein and homocysteine, both of which, when they're elevated, can increase the risk of heart attack and stroke. And you can reduce it by as much as 39% just with those two nutrients. So it's very important that you get that. And also another study in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that the higher the magnesium level in your blood, the lower your risk of heart disease and sudden cardiac death. So that's big. And this was done over an 8.7-year period, the reduction of heart disease, sudden cardiac death. This was done in the Netherlands and Erasmus University. So want to live a longer life, not had sudden heart attack? Then make sure you're getting magnesium, again, 800 to 1,200 milligrams a day. I would split it up. I would do the higher amount at night and the lower amount, because what happens is magnesium helps control the rhythm of your heartbeat when you're sleeping. And that's very important for people with sleep apnea. It's very important for people who have a history of any form of irregular heartbeat. Magnesium at night protects your heart and the rhythm of your heart. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be hearing from Chris Hedges, but we have an awful lot to cover before then, and something brand new today. By the way, you can watch today's program by going to Ustream channel and just search for Gary Nall. We have today, right in our office, for the first time in 3.5 years, a new mouthwash. It's called Fresh Breath. It's an all-natural mouthwash, mint flavor, made in the USA, no artificial flavors, no saccharin, no alcohol. Here are the ingredients. And you talk about helping your gums. Yeah. And your tongue? It does so. I hope that you realize when you wake up in the morning that the first thing you do before you eat or drink anything is you go in and take a tongue cleaner and gently scrape from the back to the front of your tongue. And then rinse your mouth with mouthwash. That gets rid of the bacteria that's in your mouth. And the phlegm, and most phlegm that people are not aware of, collects at the bottom of your inside of your lip at the gum level. If you were to take your finger in your mouth and clean, of course, and take it, even a Q-tip, and take it from one side to the other, you'd see this, more often than not, mucus, stringy mucus. That's loaded with bacteria. So you don't want to swallow that. So if people get up and drink something in the morning before they do proper oral hygiene, then they don't have that problem. If they don't, then they're taking all that bacteria and right in their system. Not a good idea. So first and foremost, I want to make sure that we use only spring water, then cherry, and then hydrogen peroxide, and potassium, and menthol, and vitamin C, and peppermint essential oil, and olive leaf oil and clove oil and tea tree oil and echinacea and aloe vera and golden seal. It just doesn't get better than this. And I would suggest that right now I will compare my mouthwash after we tested it on any mouthwash in America. In fact, here's a challenge. Try your mouthwash and gurgle around in there and swash it around for about 60 seconds ideally, and then open your mouth and see how much bacteria you can take off your tongue. Now use Fresh Breath mouthwash and see how much of those white little bubbles come up, and that is killing off bacteria, and you can take a whole lot out, tremendous amount. And then notice how long your breath stays fresh and sweet compared to any of the other mouthwashes on the market. So brand new today, and we will ship it out today. And it's a great price, and I'm going to give you the order number in just a second. So get ready to write down this order number for Fresh Breath, the all-natural mouthwash with a wonderful cherry mint flavor with the best ingredients you could imagine, and all made in USA. Here's the number to call, and I believe it's on sale for $9.99. We're introducing it. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for the Fresh Breath. That's what it's called, Fresh Breath. And it's got the spring water, it's got everything. And I took a long time to do this. And there are several of the holistic dentists who use my old mouthwash. They use the toothpaste now, but the old mouthwash. But I haven't had any since I wanted to improve it. And it's been 3.5 years, so it's the best that I can do. And I'll compare it in quality and how long it keeps your breath smelling fresh and your gums and your teeth, and your tongue. There's just nothing like it. Okay? Brand new today. And a very good special today with something that we've never offered before, ever. I'm going to give you a great gift today. You're getting a $55 savings. I've got digestive stuff just came in, but only 300 bottles, so I don't have a lot of it. This is one of the best products I've ever created. It's kosher. And it's vegan, and it's the best stuff in the world, because a lot of people at this time of the year, when the weather's changed, when there's holiday seasons, their whole systems sometimes get out of whack. And a lot of people are eating too much. Even eating too much healthy food at a single time is not good. So I invented what is called digestive stuff. It's raw, it's all natural. And here's what it has in it. I give you what your body needs at the digestive level. Papaya, pineapple, apples, bananas, bromelain, amylase, lipase, protease, cellulase, ginger, cinnamon, anise, fennel, whole leaf aloe vera that we grow down in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. We use the whole leaf. The rabbis there. We take it in, we hand process it, we put in Gota Cola and Dong Quai, and there's just nothing like this aloe vera we use. Then marshmallow root, slippery elm bark, and then 6 billion of the B. longum bacteria probiotics, and then 6 billion additional Acidophilus, 12 billion, that's with a B, 12 billion probiotics. Pineapple flavor with stevia as the sweetener extract. That's it. Nothing else is in there. It's only got 79 calories. It's got 13, almost 13 grams of fiber. So it's very high in fiber. It's terrific for you. And you take it after a meal. Called digestive stuff. Now, when you get digestive stuff today, you're also getting, for the first time, free, no cost to you, the wonderful film. It's just a poem to those who love food and cooking, The Art of Healthy Cooking, with the greatest chef in America, David Boulay. And David is the best of the best. And the music, the farmer's market, the showing the different dishes, the sit-down conversations about the power of food and what kind of food we have in our diets. So everything that you need to know about how to change from an unhealthy to a healthy diet is in this, The Art of Healthy Cooking, and it's free today for everyone who orders digestive stuff. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065, and you'll save $55. Call 877-627-5065. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break. Come right back. Please stay with us. We're going to go to our guests in just a moment, but first I wanted you to hear a couple things. I wanted you to hear about who really had the inside track on knowing what was going to be happening in Greece. I think you'll find this interesting from RT.
The establishment might have let Hillary Clinton off the hook for setting up her own email server, but her emails are still out there now for everyone to read. And people are still reading them and still finding evidence of just how crooked, crooked Hillary is. Crooked enough to be thrown in jail, for sure. Fox News has been reading through her emails, of course, and they recently did a story on something ridiculous they found. You might recall a few years ago, Greece was in a major debt crisis, launching the largest sovereign debt default in history. Clinton was Secretary of State at the time, and her emails have a lot to say about how Secretary Crooked handled it. Because at the same time, Chelsea Clinton's husband, Crooked's son-in-law, Mark Mizvinsky, was coincidentally creating a $325 million basket of offshore funds with the help of Goldman Sachs. Those funds were used to place bets on what would happen in Greece. And gosh, wouldn't you know, he was placing those bets at the same time Crooked, as Secretary of State, was sharing lots of classified information about what was going on in Greece through her private email server. She shared classified information with her Clinton Foundation cronies about what the actual leaders of Greece were saying, information at the highest level. She also emailed sensitive State Department information about Greek bonds with her husband, at the same time her son-in-law was targeting his hedge fund at Greece. In other words, she was emailing classified information about the Greek bailout to family and friends at the same time her son-in-law was placing multi-million dollar bets on what would happen in Greece. So yeah, crooked enough to be thrown in jail, which is why it's
but
so great
she won't be thrown in jail. Why? We've heard the excuses, rationalizations, and justifications from FBI Director Comey. And the media, by and large, has accepted that. But there's a former FBI assistant director, that's the person right under the FBI director, who has a different perspective. Let's hear what he has to say on why Hillary Clinton should have been indicted, but was not.
Us wrong, but don't call us weasels. We are not weasels. We are honest people, and we did this in that way. Whether you disagree or agree with the result, this was done the way you would want it to be done.
What concerns me, Director, is when you have five immunity agreements and no prosecution, when you are allowing witnesses who happen to be lawyers, who happen to be targets, to sit in on an interview. That is not the FBI that I used to work with.
I hope someday when this political crisis is over, you will look back again on this, because this is the FBI you know and love. This was done by pros in the right way. That's the part I have no patience for.
We've got former FBI Assistant Director Jim Kallstrom. He has fought so hard to protect this country, and he's been critical of Mr. Comey's decision not to basically recommend an indictment or prosecution of Hillary Clinton. He joins me now via phone. Sir, is this the FBI you know and love?
Hi, Liz. You know, I think it really is the FBI. If people are criticizing Director Comey, they're not criticizing all the great agents that work for the FBI. They're criticizing him and his hierarchy for running a, I don't know, just, I can't even explain, you know, just looking at all the press on this case, I do not understand why they conducted the investigation they conducted. It's just out of control. When do you round up all the other co-conspirators and give them immunity? I don't believe that's ever happened in my lifetime.
What do you think?
You know, it's just every time he talks, he gets himself in deeper and deeper trouble. And now the second release on a Friday afternoon of major information. Yeah. I mean, that's just outrageous. The FBI should not be in that game.
What do you think is happening behind the scenes at the FBI?
Well, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more of the facts come out over the course of the next few months. That's my prediction. I think it's a boiling cauldron in the FBI, quite frankly. And I think, this is just my opinion, I have no inside information on this, but I have been contacted by literally hundreds and hundreds of people about this case, a lot of which are retired agents and a few that are on the job now that weren't part of this investigation, but are just so upset about the fact that he, you know, whether he's tried or not, you know, I used to think he was a great guy. I recommended to Judge Pataki that he be the U.S. attorney in New York. You know, so I don't get any joy out of saying these things I'm saying, but what he's done is just absolutely contrary to how the FBI operates.
So,
and I'm sure the agents involved in this thing feel like they've been stabbed in the back.
So they're upset about mishandling of classified information, I gather. And do you think there's been political pressure put on Mr. Comey?
Well, unless somebody's come down from, you know, the Martians have come down and gotten his head, I don't understand any other reason why he would be doing what he's doing. Since when the Congress sends a letter to someone, a subpoena and a letter identifying them not to destroy any evidence, and then after the fact, they summarily destroy all this evidence, that's obstruction of justice. That's a federal felony. And that's been conducted by numerous people. When do you have people who are potential co-conspirators in the interview with the main conspirator? When does that ever happen? And when do they call all the shots? I mean, I think it's just an outrageous series of events that's taken place.
So that's just a different perspective, one that the mainstream media did not offer as a balance to Comey's justification that he didn't feel that she had intent. Therefore, he let it slide. Do you think you and I would be given that opportunity to walk out of jail? No, we wouldn't. We're going to share some perspective now about the world we live in, and especially those within the Orthodox media and the political establishment who use the idea that someone may be angry and protesting as showing they're uncivil or they shouldn't be given any acknowledgement, or even today, if you are protesting, you could be considered a domestic terrorist. Environmental protesters who are protesting against gas hydrofracking, those who are against the wetland destruction, those who are against the habitat loss in the United States, around the world, they're now considered domestic terrorists. There's entire profiles in every single person that protests today. Even if you just protest online, if you sign a petition, you're now a target. Well, wonder what we could learn from this man's construct about the role of anger and righteous indignation and how we should understand those who are compliant, those who do not ever protest, those who do not raise their voice in outrage against injustice are part of the problem and not the solution. Listen in, please.
The Muslims who have accepted the religion of Islam and follow the religious guidance of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad have never bombed any churches, have never murdered any little girls, as was done in Birmingham, have never lynched anybody, have never at any time been guilty of initiating any aggressive acts of violence during the entire 33 years or more that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has been teaching us. The charge of violence against us actually stems from the guilt complex that exists in the conscious and subconscious minds of most white people in this country. They know that they've been violent in their brutality against Negroes, and they feel that someday the Negro is going to wake up and try and do unto them as they have done unto, do unto the whites as the whites have done unto us. We aren't a violent group. We are taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to obey the law, to respect everyone who respects us. We're taught to display courtesy, to be polite. But we're also taught that at any time anyone in any way inflicts or seeks to inflict violence upon us, we are within our religious rights to retaliate in self-defense to the maximum degree of our ability. We never initiate any violence upon anyone, but if anyone attacks us, we reserve the right to defend ourselves. So to accuse us of being violent is like accusing a man who is being lynched, who is being hung on a tree, simply because he struggles vigorously against his lyncher. The victim is accused of violence, but the lyncher is never accused of violence. And I only point this out because the various racist groups that are set up in this country by whites and who have actually practiced violence against blacks for 400 years are never associated or identified or made synonymous with the term violence. But whites speak of Muslims almost synonymously with violence. Whenever Muslims are mentioned by them, violence is brought up. But it's not connected with any other group. This is a sort of a propaganda tactic, or what I would call psychological warfare, to in some way make the image of the Muslims in this country be a violent image rather than a religious image.
That was October 11th, 1963, and Malcolm X. How prophetic his statement. Think of what he just said. We look at the person struggling against institutional violence, trying to survive, and we consider that person violent because of their efforts at survival. And yet the perpetrators of that were never questioned. Think now the neoconservatives, both Democrats and liberals and conservatives and Republicans, who sponsor violence against other people. Think of all the people in Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Mali. Think of all the countries where we have perpetrated violence, and yet we consider them violent if they're struggling to survive our incursions. We just don't even have an honest dialogue on these topics, and that's unfortunate. I was just told Chris Hedges is on the line, and I gave you his introduction earlier, but I'll mention again that Chris is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics and social and political activist and investigative journalist. For almost 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America and the Middle East and Africa and Balkans, having reported for the New York Times and the Christian Science Monitor. And while at the Times, Chris received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. In that same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. He is the author of Unspeakable, talks with David Talbot about the most forbidden topics in America, which is a very candid conversation on some of the most important issues and themes of our times that mainstream media simply refuses to discuss. Chris also has a weekly talk show, On Contact, interviews with prominent dissidents ignored by the media, and airs every Saturday on Russia TV or RTV.com. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris, when I think of what is or is not unspeakable, what is taboo from entering the public discourse or is intentionally censored, I immediately think of the state of our mainstream media. Your old employer, the New York Times, has been criticized for its lack of journalistic integrity. For example, you knew Judith Miller during the time of 9/11, who contributed greatly to the faux story of Iran's weapons of mass destruction. And at that time, you were sent to Paris for your own fact-finding mission about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, and your reports, from what I understand, were not published. And now the Times again is promoting Washington's lies about Syria, Russia. It promoted lies about Libya. And Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett in Beirut was on our program last night speaking about her fact-finding journeys into Syria, five of them, spending weeks and months at a time, and especially in and around Aleppo, and her conclusion that practically everything we're being told about Syria and Assad, who is bombing whom and what the people feel about Assad, is simply false information. So share, please, with us the culture of pseudoscience and news in our mainstream media based upon some of your personal experience, and just how bad is it now since you left corporate media to pursue an independent career?
Well, this is the book that you mentioned, Unspeakable, is David Talbot, a very fine journalist in his own right, founder of Salon.com, who interviews me. And it's interesting for me because there are questions I don't usually get. And there is a long chapter on the New York Times and the press. And we talk about 9/11 as an example. Judy Miller represents everything I detest in establishment journalism. And yet, she was used as a scapegoat. This was an institutional failure on the part of the New York Times. It was not just Judy Miller who perpetuated and disseminated and amplified the lies of the Bush administration. It was the institution as a whole. I was, as you said, based in Paris covering Al-Qaeda. And the French were apoplectic about President Bush's call to invade Iraq, arguing quite correctly that Iraq had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, and that it was diverting resources from actually dealing with jihadist terrorism, and ultimately by using the instrument of conventional war, feeding the very jihadist movement, which has now created the debacle in the Middle East, the failed states, the rise of ISIS, and everything else. So I had kind of carte blanche at the highest levels of the French government in terms of access to their intelligence, in the hopes that by publishing this in the New York Times, it would dissuade the American public from embracing what is, I think, probably the most disastrous strategic decision in American history. It didn't work. I remember coming back to New York and sitting around the room with the investigative team and laying out what the French had, and it was just dismissed. It was a sense of kind of chauvinism and nationalism. Well, what do the French know? You know, our sources, Lewis, Scooter, Libby, et cetera, are saying this. And they just wouldn't, you know, they had all drunk the Kool-Aid. So there's one example. The 2008 meltdown, you know, is another one, because here you have an elitist publication that spends all of its time interviewing Jamie Rubin and Larry Summers and all these figures, and completely missed, because they were not in marginal communities, the foundation of sand through subprime mortgages that led to the financial collapse. And that isn't a problem, and it's a huge problem. It has been, I think, exacerbated now, especially on the commercial airwaves, where, unlike the New York Times, these so-called news entities no longer make any attempt to do journalism. It's all about ratings. They look at themselves as a revenue stream. competing against numerous other revenue streams in large corporations like Viacom or General Electric. They are judged solely on their ability to produce revenue, not on their ability to produce news. There's been a complete surrendering on the part of the commercial media of journalism itself. I think the New York Times, and I read it every day, still does journalism, but we always have to read the New York Times with the caveat that it is first and foremost geared towards the elites, the political and economic elites, and that its unwritten motto, as I said in the book with David, is do not significantly alienate those on whom we depend for access and money. You can alienate them once in a while. But if you are a reporter who is like Charlie LaDuff or Sidney Schamberg, who we just lost, or others, who will actually go after the elites on behalf of the average person, you're going to get pushed out of the institution. The Times, when set against the utter bankruptcy of what journalism has become in this country, in particular on the airwaves, looks pretty good. But you always have to read it with that understanding that this has been and is and always will be an organ of the elites, and too often serves uncritically as a mouthpiece for those elites.
Appreciate that insight. Thank you. I took a look at the history of the stories published about the coup in Honduras. We now have through WikiLeaks irrefutable proof that Hillary Clinton was central to that coup. Also the coup in the Ukraine, and then blaming everything on Moscow. Now we have no proof whatsoever, except Hillary Clinton say that from unnamed sources in our intelligence division, she was told that Russian Vladimir Putin was behind the latest leaks because they want Donald Trump to become president. And yet WikiLeaks shows that she's been in collaboration with the CNN reporters and people with the New York Times and other news outlets, and now nothing is being done. The Times did not review critically any of the false statements about Libya. And I went back to read the statements, the front page articles about Libya and the justification for it. And it was just like Iraq, and the same way with Syria.
Right.
There's been no honest, objective journalism, and yet there are journalists going into Syria, have been in Iraq, look at the consequences of Afghanistan, and they're writing completely different stories. Seymour Hersh wrote a completely different story about who was responsible for the poison gas in Syria. The Times said it was the Assad regime and has been supportive of the regime change without any, they have not done any major investigative report that our allies are part of who's arming and training or protecting ISIS or al-Nusra, and that should make headline news. And yet they will continue to deny this, even though this is in one of the latest WikiLeaks where Hillary Clinton herself acknowledges that ISIS is being supported by both Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Well, that should create a dialogue of how then close should we be? How many weapons should we sell them, if any? What support should we have for them if they are then arming and abetting terrorism that we're now being affected by? Your thoughts on this, please.
Right. Well, this is part of the whole insane policy of over the last year pumping $1 billion worth of weapons into a chaotic, anarchic mess. The idea that you can trace where these weapons go or end up is nuts. I've worked in these types of failed states and zones from the Congo to Yemen and everywhere else. So, it is an absolutely crazy policy, but it has a kind of dark logic to it, and that is the same reason for the expansion of NATO. You mentioned the Ukraine. It is about enriching arms manufacturers, and that is basically what drives our foreign policy. It doesn't make any sense to expand NATO beyond Germany. Indeed, Reagan, when the wall fell, had promised Gorbachev that we would not expand NATO beyond Germany. But of course, Raytheon, Halliburton, Northrop Grumman, they all want those markets, and they've got them. So I just got back from Poland a few weeks ago. I landed at the airport in Warsaw. What's the first gigantic advertisement billboard I see in the airport? It's from Raytheon. And so with the assault of neoliberalism, you have 2 million Poles working abroad. The assault of neoliberalism is giving rise to these kind of fascist regimes in countries like Poland and Hungary that speak in the bellicose language of war, and who do they want to go to war with? It's Russia. Then you have the arms manufacturers flooding these countries with weapons, and of course they're using resources they don't have to buy these weapons. And you see this cabal, including Robert Kagan, around Clinton, and all they do is talk about Russia. Remember, these are the people who brought us the invasion of Iraq and the mess in the Middle East. So I find that rhetoric, I'm not defending, you know, Putin, I'm just saying I find that rhetoric and that demonization of Russia very, very frightening and very similar to what we saw in the lead-up to the war in Iraq and the kind of demonization of Saddam Hussein. And I was in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. He was pretty awful, but he wasn't a threat to himself and a threat to his neighbors, and he wasn't a threat to us. So, history is repeating itself. I don't get the point of carrying out a coup d'etat in the Ukraine, which they did, and pushing NATO right up to the borders of Russia. I mean, how would we feel? How did we feel when the Soviets talked about putting nuclear missiles in Cuba? I mean, so it has no logic in terms of its furtherance of international security or even our own national security. It has a logic only for people who want to get rich selling weapons.
Chris, I know that there are other journalists listening right now. If you could offer a word of advice in journalistic style on how to best challenge the prevailing stories and myths coming out of Washington that distort the facts on the ground, what would it be? And why is it so difficult to get the truth out? And perhaps you can use the Middle East as an example, since we have been lied to so often by Washington and our national security state through the mouthpiece of the mainstream media.
Well, if your primary goal as a journalist is access, and that's what elite publications like The Times prize, it's what these celebrity journalists who make millions of dollars a year on the commercial networks prize, then you're not going to alienate those elites. And you are going to slavishly amplify what the elites want amplified. That isn't journalism. That's a kind of being a stenographer to the powerful. And yet that dominates so much of mainstream journalism. I know reporters who their entire career have sat at a desk rewriting official government or corporate copy, and they are kind of esteemed figures within the journalistic establishment, and yet I would argue they've never actually done a day of journalism in their life. So there's that tension between those of us who worked within the system. I was at the New York Times for 15 years, although always overseas, who attempt to go out and report and challenge the dominant narrative, but we run into friction, not only from the power elites, but from our own institution. And we clash with our own institution because you have whole Washington bureaus that make their living, I'm talking about the reporters, doing lunch with the powerful. And that's a story as old as, corporate journalism, going back to William Randolph Hearst. It's always been the alternative publications, Bob Shearer's Ramparts magazine that exposed COINTELPRO, this government FBI program to spy and carry out dirty tricks against dissidents and anti-war activists, that printed the iconic picture of the little girl running down the road naked, being burned by napalm. And the real journalism has come from the fringes. I.F. Stone, Ida B. Wells, the great investigative reporter who exposed the reality of lynching as a form of social control, a reign of terror, conscious reign of terror by the power elites in the South. That's all never come from the mainstream. That has come from, the real journalists who don't get that kind of institutional support and often that kind of remuneration to do their work, because they will directly challenge the centers of power in the way that commercial publications are very reluctant to do.
I remember Covert Action Quarterly for many years.
Right.
Bringing stories no one else would touch.
Right.
One thing that I notice is irony. And I just would like you to think about answering this question from the point of irony. On the one hand, when we find out about Donald Trump and his, you know, locker room mindset and his misogyny and his vulgarity and his crudeness, the entire liberal community seemed to have gone into an epileptic convulsion of outrage and indignation. And then I said, but hold on a moment. Before you do that, as bad, as grotesque, as gross as that was, why don't we turn around and look at the rest of America? Now, in The Empire of Illusion, and again in Unspeakable, you address the impact of pornography on
right.
the American culture. And historically, right. by the way, just so we put this in perspective, when I look at the latest statistics, it's now a $100 billion year industry, and most of pornography is based upon the objectification, and a lot of that is the objectification and dehumanization of women as objects.
And violence.
And
violence. Real violence.
And then the impact of the sex culture. And it's scary how many Americans are engaged in it. And now the child porn industry is $3 billion a year. And then you have this cheater's website called Ashley Madison that was hacked that has 37 million subscribers. And then you have the rap culture, which is estimated to be between 22 and 37% lyrics containing misogynist references and violent references. And in the military, you have 1 in 4 women and 1 in 14 men have been sexually harassed. And you have argued that the dehumanizing aspect of the porn industry and its proliferation through our culture is a reflection of the degrading agenda of the global capitalism. So before we singularly attack Trump, should we not also take a look at our own sexual perversions and our own sexual and violent temperament? And then on top of that, if you're going to dehumanize women and vulgarize it, what does it say when you support and enable Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations that dehumanize women there and rape women, and in different areas of Pakistan and India, a woman can be killed, and historically very little done against the perpetrator in these honor killings because they did something or fell in love or got married or eloped with someone they didn't want, the family didn't want. And so shouldn't we take an honest look at who the rest of America is who's pointing a finger at Trump to see how widespread this pathology actually is?
Well, Trump is kind of the poster child for celebrity culture and for the commodification of other human beings and for the cult of the self and the idea that leadership and success is defined by financial worth. I'm not defending what Trump did. By the way, I spent many, many years in a locker room, and we never spoke like that. That's the way the elites speak about everyone. Now, that's especially white male elites. Clinton's language, I can assure you in private, is no different from Donald Trump's. It wasn't a locker room language. It's white male privilege language. Because everybody around them is an object that they manipulate and use for their own gratification and empowerment, male or female. And the weaker you are, the more, in some sense, they despise you. And that's what the window into what we saw with Trump's comments. And remember, they all come from the same club. I mean, Trump probably is correct when he says that he's heard Clinton say even worse things out on the golf course, because they were playing golf together. Hillary Clinton was sitting in the front row of Donald Trump's third wedding. It's all the same grotesque cabal of, you know, ultra rich, including that insane or, you know, ridiculous debate where Anderson Cooper is worth about $100 million, and Martha Raddatz is worth about $7 million. It was four multimillionaires with the backdrop of a quote-unquote town hall where two or three people or maybe four or five got to ask scripted questions read off of cards that were selected by the elites. I mean, so I think that Trump's grotesque behavior, I think you're right, is symptomatic of the objectification and commodification of women throughout the culture. We're a completely pornified culture. It's interesting that in the book, David Talbot is not buying my argument. He's pushing very hard against me on that, in that section where we talk about pornography. But I think it's the quintessential example of, you know, of kind of capitalism itself, where because pornography is just filmed prostitution, it's about eviscerating the humanity of the other, in this case girls and women, and using them as objects for self-gratification. So Trump, you know, does more of it and expresses it more lewdly and because he's richer. But you're right. It is symptomatic of the disease throughout the wider society.
Chris, we're out of time. Thank you very much for your good work. And we look forward. I watch your television show as much as I can. I really like it. The new book is Unspeakable, Talks with David Talbot About the Most Forbidden Topics in America. And Chris's show is Saturday on RT. It's called On Contact. Look forward to our next discussion, Chris.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
I love you, girl, with all my heart and soul. Can't understand why you treat me cold. Your every wish, girl.